Welcome back to Teaching Matters, the University of Edinburgh's hub for discussing, promoting, and showcasing teaching and learning across the university. We're a website, blog, podcast, and most importantly, a small group of people passionate about providing platforms for conversations surrounding teaching and learning. I'm Sylvia, second-year PhD student and an intern at Teaching Matters, and I'll be walking you through this presentation. In today's episode, we feature James Stewart, lecturer at the Science, Technology, and Innovation Studies at the University of Edinburgh. With Vesalis asking questions and steering their conversation, James provides a comprehensive exploration of AI in education. Whether you are an educator, a student, or simply someone who's curious about the future of education in the age of AI, this episode is packed with insights and reflections that you won't want to miss. Without further ado, let's hear from James Stewart.
I'm James Stewart. I'm a lecturer in Science Technology Studies at the university. I've been working on information technology all my career. And about 10 years ago, we started working on very much focus on the data that are in the computer systems rather than just the computer system themselves. Most of my kind of work has been on how computer systems are designed, the exclusions, the harms, the digital divide questions. But at the same time, also looking at how different industries and different parts of society appropriate technology and make it work for them. And this is, I think, what we've got an exciting period now. We've got a new technology. All sorts of people are looking for the opportunities, but also recognizing there's a set of challenges.
Vesalis, would you like to kickstart this conversation by asking your first question?
James, if you could brief us a bit about your vast experience as a lecturer in all these subjects about ICTs and digital technologies and the internet and data science and stuff. How do you feel encountering these sort of at the educational level? How do you feel receiving all these essays, you know, that you're not really sure, certain whether, you know, they have sections of it have been written by GPT and so on? How do you feel about it? What are like any methods you have considered in tackling? Is it important? Is it something we should look at? Or
we tend to, with new technologies, to get some people who say, yeah, I don't want to have to think about it. Let's leave it till later. While others are sort of grabbing the opportunities right at the beginning. Within the university, we have a mix. We have some people who are obviously at the front line of developing the technical side of things. We have a few people who are saying, yes, we can really do something new with this technology. But probably most people are saying, oh, I've got enough on my plate already. But as soon as we start getting things like students writing essays using ChatGPT, then it's like, oh no, we have to do something about it. So like with most technologies, most people are actually forced into thinking about it rather unwillingly and don't come very well equipped with the how to think about it and see it more as a problem to be overcome rather than opportunity to be grasped. Most times where we get academic misconduct is when students are getting desperate. They haven't been supported enough as we go along, and therefore at the last minute they resort to the simplest, worst way is copying text. If you've got money, then they pay someone to do it. Sometimes we can detect when they pay someone to do it. Sometimes, for example, in social science, they ask someone who is more used to writing kind of economics or science papers and are saying, this is completely wrong. And sometimes they get someone who writes it better. We know there is a problem of even PhDs being written by people who've been paid to do it. But this is things we deal with all the time. There's a whole lot of tales, as it were, that we can work out where things have gone wrong. We check all the references as we go along. As soon as we find a reference that doesn't exist, we say, oh, the student has cited five different sources, but they're cited in exactly the same order as they are in the main paper that they're using. I mean, it's not that hard to work out. It's just a bit of a pain, and I feel kind of personally insulted when I have to do this. They say, why didn't you come and talk to me about this before? But there's ways to deal with it. I think it always involves much closer working with the students. Now, there's some really interesting ways about how we, rather than just kind of writing papers, how we use this technology to help understand what we're reading. So one of the problems we get, you know, I give students paper to read and they struggle to understand it. The language models are actually what they're really good at. It's not the knowledge that's embedded in them, but the way they act as tools for working with language. So you can upload a paper to ChatGPT and then say, I want you to ask me some questions about this paper that I will then try and answer. Then you will tell me whether my answer is good. And you will help me answer questions. So it's a much more interactive way, the same as I would do as a teacher sitting down with a student talking about the paper. Actually, these language models are good at that. You just have to work out, you know, how you use it. I think it's going to be really important. So how, when you're not getting the personalized help from your tutors, how can I use this technology in the same sort of way to build my own understanding? That's one example of how we would use it.
That's extremely useful, James. Thank you very much, because I know some of the things he's been working on with GPT right now. So I think that we would like to learn a bit more about the broader technical landscape of GPT, so the value chain, as we call it. If you could brief us a bit about who are the big players in the field and how do we end up having GPT in front of our screens?
We have all sorts of labs and startups coming into the field. See, the biggest model has been made open to researchers comes from Abu Dhabi. In China, they talk about the 70 very large models that they produce. And this is something that is being produced all around the world by organizations that have got a lot of money. They're still at the moment mostly research-led. And actually, that diversity is really interesting. We're talking about India starting to produce their first large model. So, you know, we often have this talk about, these are just produced by kind of privileged white men. Well, actually, they're probably produced by privileged men of any color and any ethnicity and a lot of different political situations. So that's one thing that we see. But we've got another two kind of key groups. We've got the industry that is, or the nascent industry that is bringing the data to train these models. So you need essentially a data set that has got trillions of what they call tokens, essentially like words or parts of words. And the training of these large models was essentially come out of research and people putting together whatever they can collect, normally from the internet. They can be collections of images, and like in ImageNet, collections of pirated books, and the sorts of things that you can download from a website. Almost anything that's got text or images, so that you can train a text or an image model. The same thing with music. And in a research context, where you know almost anything goes, and none of these organizations were really thinking about, our material is going to be used to train these models at scale. So some of the main research data sets that have been used to train these early models actually are licensed, if they actually already got a license, as research only, but they're already being put into commercialized models. You have then some key players in the world of publishing data that are very upset by this. For example, the Getty Photographic Library, who is defending not only their own economic interests, they're defending the interests of their people who basically put images into their library, who do it as a job. You have the social platforms like Twitter or X, who suddenly realize that they've got this key resource that's been used by the other companies, Reddit as well. Both of these organizations have shut down access to their full databases because they say, well, we want some control over this. Either we're going to sell it or we're going to do our own models. And then you've got all sorts of other types of organizations that are collecting this data and cleaning it. And actually, the basis of the modern models is often the machine learning techniques to clean up these data sets so you can use them in research. So we have this development of an industry to produce the training data. The rules are not set yet. The House of Commons committee came out with a suggestion that, you know, that we need to think about, do we protect the rights of authors so allow the their creative goods to be used to train AIs without their permission. And then the musicians union were going into number 10 lobbying, saying, this is, you can't possibly do this. We have quite a few court cases in the US about artists saying that their works have been used to train a model without their permission. And one of the questions is, they haven't even been asked whether this could happen, but the models then can produce things that look like their art and will therefore not, and they're sufficiently close to be considered the derivative work, and therefore they should have rights to it. And also that if other people can use this to produce works that look like these artists' works, and therefore that takes away future work from them and also confuses about the image about what is them. Now, of course, in the world of commercial art, all the time, commercial artists are being asked to, produce something in the style of so-and-so. So that is, it's not an unusual thing. It's not only the artists producing the really novel stuff, but it's the commercial artists who are producing derivative stuff as well. They're all unhappy about this. So on that side, the other side is once you train one of these big models, and that takes an awful lot of, the designing the architecture of the model is very challenging, and there's a few big architectures out there. Then you can train the model and you can either release the weights or you can keep them proprietary. Well, one of the problems with the models is that they don't do anything very good. What you need to do is train them with human feedback to do particular sorts of jobs. So when you talk about ChatGPT, ChatGPT is the GPT 3.5 model that has been trained with a lot of human input in order to act as a chatbot. They have another version which has been trained to do summaries. Another version has been trained to produce computer code. Each of those involves hundreds of thousands of people and probably costs a lot more than the original training of the core model. Some of this work is being done by the big corporations like OpenAI, who know they have to do this. And this is why they released ChatGPT. And one of the reasons it's released to the public is that so that they get a lot of feedback on whether people like the output or not. They also have to include other machine learning tools to do moderation, to do a bunch of other functions that produce a particular application. So it's not just like the one big model that is ChatGPT. No, it's a bunch of different models that all have to work together. So we have a lot of companies now that are working with the core models in order then to try and produce these so-called fine-tuned models. So there's a lot of science going in about when you fine-tune it very much to do one task, it can be absolutely terrible at any other task. So the so-called fine-tuning industry is growing. And then once you fine-tune it, then you may say, well, actually, now we want to get to work on our particular set of data. So for the main investment now around generative AI is going into producing corporate knowledge management tools and customer engagement tools. But I was saying corporate management is one of the big problems in knowledge management is your company has got so much material and you can't find what you want in it. What they want is to be able to get one of these generative tools that will find and summarize everything a company knows about something. That is, there's hundreds of millions of dollars going into that at the moment. And that is, that's really the place where you bridge between the fine-tuned models and what can be used in companies. Now, companies really are very worried about putting their own corporate data into the public domain. So this the big effort. How do we bridge between these very big combinations of models that produce an application and all the corporate data so that it can be used in a company? So you have another industry there, and then you have this another whole kind of growth in this value network, which is about providing the moderation services, about providing developing the standards, about testing, doing independent testing of models, about developing regulation, about working out how regulation to converts into tests. So we have another whole industry, which is about essentially about regulation of the models, and which draws on all of these. And then we have finally the companies that and other organizations like government are trying to incorporate these applications into their everyday work. And they have to get together to work out how they can support each other. So we have a whole network of, what if you work in the advertising industry? Now every advertising conference and and all the consultants that do that, they're all trying to work out between them, what does this mean for their industry? So this is a whole new space for AI experts to go and work in essentially the user side. So I see those as the kind of the main areas in which we have development of commerce, research, professions. So even if you can't get a job in AI or Microsoft, you can still go and get one working and supporting the publishing industry or the advertising industry or in government, in trying to do that, like how do we make sure this works for us? So I think that's where we are at the moment.
Thank you very much, James. This is an impressive assessment of the current value chain. I wish our listeners could see impressive visualization of the network, but maybe they could reach out to you and ask you.
As we are coming to the end of this series, can I ask Vasilis, Irene, and Laura to join in and share a few words to our listeners? We would like to hear from you your take-home message.
So I would like to take the opportunity to thank Sylvia and Josephine for having us here today. We need more of this type of conversations. They're very much needed, as the content of what we have said indicates. I think today's conversation highlights the need for more social science understandings of the technological content. And we need more people who are sensitized to look into broader social issues, to treat these technologies not as the illnesses of a given social context, but the symptoms of existing social illnesses. I think that's something that for me underpins most of the comments that we have heard.
Well, I think this podcast is wonderful. We've covered many topics, the commercial industrial side to the academia side, and a few concerns, both the education perspective and the student's perspective of the use of these AI tools. Well, I think many of us have mentioned the double-edged sword feature of AI software. And from a student perspective, I think it is important to see AI software as a supplement rather than a substitute.
My take-home message here is the fact that these technologies are sort of parrots, as one famous paper states. They reproduce biases from an inherently biased world, because that's what we have. So if we want them to function differently, then it's up to us to introduce additional biases within these models so that they can function in a less toxic manner based on whichever context we want them to function in. And this could happen in academia, this could happen in government settings, but really it's up to us to understand and decide how we want to change the functionality of this technology and what data we want to introduce.
That's a perfect way to end this episode. I'm sure we'll continue to have similar conversations in this topic. We would like to thank our amazing guests of this series, Vasilis, James, Lara, and Irene. Thank you for bringing this important discussion to the table and discussing this topic from varied perspectives. We loved it. We hope our listeners enjoyed it too. Thank you for listening to this episode of Teaching Matters. Teaching Matters is brought to you by the University of Edinburgh's Institute of Academic Development. For more posts and conversations about teaching and learning, head to our blog. We'd be delighted for you to join these conversations. To do so, just email us, teachingmatters@ed.ac.uk. You can also find us on Twitter. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider following us on Spotify or subscribing on Apple Podcasts and leaving a 5-star review. Music for this episode was provided by Hook Sounds. In the meantime, stay curious.